I'm Bill Murphy here with Chris Sports, and we will do the baseball first. Yesterday, the Red Sox and the Guardians played a day game, and the Red Sox went 4-2 on their second road trip of the year, sweeping the Pirates in Pittsburgh and avoiding getting swept by the Guardians in Cleveland. After their first homestand culminated in a blemished 3-7 mark to begin the Fenway season, it was a much-needed palate cleanser. But the trip ended on a period rather than an exclamation point. The Sox lost Thursday series finale 6-4, taking some of the wind out of their sails before their return to Boston. Making his first start of the year in place of the injured Brian Bayo, Chase Anderson escaped a jam in the first inning but couldn't get through the second. He gave up a solo home run to Will Brennan, then loaded the bases on a pair of walks and hit by pitch, setting the stage for Jose Ramirez. With two outs and nowhere to put Cleveland's top slugger, Anderson tried in vain to end the frame. Ramirez fouled one pitch into Reese McGuire's glove, but the catcher was unable to hang out for the out, and on the 10th pitch of the at-bat, he wowed a grand slam. "A good battle," Alex Cora told reporters. "I made a good pitch, and he's a good hitter," Anderson told reporters. "You're hoping Reese can hold on to that ball, but I've still got to make a pitch right there. Came back from 3-0, fought back in that count, was one pitch away, and unfortunately, I threw a cutter that came back over the plate, and he put a good swing on it." After a resounding 8-0 victory on Wednesday night, in which Willie Abreu and Connor Wong each contributed four hits, including a two-run homer night for Wong and Rafael Devers three, it was a frustrating afternoon for the lineup as they tried and failed to overcome the early deficit. They're 1-6 when opponents score first. The lineup chipped away and managed to cut Cleveland's lead to 1. Rob Refsnyder's RBI triple got Boston on the board in the top of the third, and he scored their second run on Abreu's sacrifice fly. In the top of the sixth, Seydan Rafaela ground out to score David Hamilton, and after striking out in his first three at-bats and going 0-for-5 the night before, Jeran Duran connected for an RBI single, driving in what would ultimately be the team's last run of the contest. It was encouraging to see Devers continue to look like himself. He went 3-for-5 and scored a run. Refsnyder continues to be an extra base machine. Since coming off the injured list last Thursday, he's 9-for-21 with four doubles, a triple, and a home run. And while Abreu snapped his hitting in on-base streaks, he's now driven in at least one run in 7 consecutive games, something no Red Sox player under 25 years old had done since Mookie Betts in 2016 and Jim Rice in 1977. The hard-hitting outfielder entered the day leading qualified rookies in on-base percentage, 4.412. Cora had been hoping for a much deeper start from Anderson, but thanks to Cooper Criswell's 5-inning performance the night before and Tanner Houck's 6-inning bid for a second consecutive complete game in Tuesday's series opener, the Sox skipper had a fairly well-rested Boston bullpen. Brennan Bernardino, Cam Boozer, Greg Weisart, Chris Martin, and Kenley Jansen pitched the rest of the way. The only run the Guardians scored was unearned. Nevertheless, Thursday was a reminder of how crucial the starting rotation has been thus far. The pitching staff has been able to mask several areas of inadequacy, including their MLB leading error count, which rose by 2 on Thursday, and the lineup's continued struggles to drive in their base runners. The Guardians plated their sixth and final run on a pair of throwing errors by McGuire. After singling and stealing second in the bottom of the eighth, Ramirez advanced to third on the catcher's first error. He quickly scored when Martin failed to cover the plate after a pass ball, and McGuire made his second miscue. On Thursday, the Sox outhit their hosts 10-8, but struck out 12 times, only drew two walks and went 1-for-7 with runners in scoring position, stranding 8 men. They left the bases loaded in the top of the second, only to have Ramirez get the job done in the bottom of the inning. The Red Sox begin their second homestand on Friday, hosting the Chicago Cubs for a three-game set over the weekend. Cutter Crawford will start game one against Chicago's new ace, Shota Imanaga. Josh Winkowski and Tanner Houck will start Saturday. That'll be a 4:10 p.m. game, and Sunday at 7 p.m. respectively. That's the Sunday night game. After a day off on Monday, Mike Yastrzemski and the San Francisco Giants come to town for a trio. And we'll give you the scores of yesterday's games. In the American League, Minnesota 6, Chicago White Sox 3, Seattle 4, Texas 3. In an interleague game, Chicago Cubs 3, Houston 1. In the National League, Milwaukee 7, Pittsburgh 5, Philadelphia 5, Cincinnati nothing, Colorado 10, San Diego 9, Los Angeles Dodgers 2, Washington 1. And we have a story from the Yankees. When the Yankees first acquired Clay Holmes from the Pirates, midway through the 2021 season, the trade didn't receive much fanfare. It didn't deserve to, as the righty had a 5.57 ERA over 91 career games for Pittsburgh. The long grind of an MLB season requires depth moves, and Holmes appeared to be nothing more. Fast forward to present day, and Holmes has established himself as one of baseball's most reliable closers, a job he seized from Aroldis Chapman during the 2022 season. An all-star that year, Holmes entered Thursday's series finale against the A's with a 2.32 ERA and 53 saves over 165 games with the Yankees. I neglected to give you the Yankee-Oakland score. It was a late game, and the Oakland A's defeated the Yankees by a score of 3-1 last night. Now, continuing with the article, that includes, this is Holmes, a 0.00 ERA and 9 saves, 10 drives over 12 games last season. I just think he's really good, Aaron Boone recently said, though some like to debate that notion because Holmes is not your prototypical overpowering closer. Instead, Holmes primarily relies on a sinker-slider combo to induce ground balls, which he's done at a 67.5% clip since putting on the pinstripes. That willingness to pitch to contact has led to some hiccups for Holmes and a Yankees bullpen that hasn't struck many people out this season. But such is life when the ball is in play and your infield makes some early season errors. He's always handled those really well, Boone said Thursday, of Holmes' ability to get past inevitable bumps in the road. Holmes has also occasionally doomed himself by losing command of his signature sinker. However, he had only walked one batter this season prior to Thursday. I feel like he's just got a better handle of his delivery, of his arsenal, of when something's not exactly right, being able to correct on the fly better, Boone said. So I just feel like he's a more complete and polished pro, and it's a credit to him and his work ethic and his mindset and his professionalism. Still, Holmes' contact-oriented approach can cause some heartburn from time to time, especially for a fan base that was spoiled by Mariano Rivera's lockdown career. Holmes is no unanimous Hall of Famer like the Sandman, but he's certainly looked better than some want to give him credit for. Obviously, since we've had him, he's been really, really good for the last few years, Boone said. But he's never really satisfied. He's always working to get a little bit better all the time at his craft. And I feel like we have a more polished, complete pitcher than even the one that we've had and seen dominate at different times over the last few years. Holmes' strong arm has come in a pivotal year as the 31-year-old making $6 million is slated for free agency after the season. It's unclear if the Yankees will make a serious run at retaining him. Big relief deals have backfired on the team in the recent past after no extension talks were held in spring training. The Yankees also have a knack for developing relievers out of nowhere. Holmes is a perfect example. However, Holmes has shown that he can pitch in New York. That alone may be worth further investment. You can't have a better guy makeup-wise in between the ears, Boone said. There's a lot right that Clay does in who he is as a person and as a pro and as an athlete. He takes care of himself. He works. That's how you draw it up. And that's why he handles the pressures of being the closer for the Yankees so well and is equipped to handle the inevitable highs and lows that come with that. The Yankees claimed right-handed reliever Michael Tonkin off waivers from the Mets on Thursday to make room on the 40-man roster the Yankees designated McKinley Moore for assignment. Tonkin, 34, has a 4.44 ERA over 192 MLB games. He's a ground ball guy who leans on sliders, fastballs, and sinkers. Boone said the veteran could give the Yankees some length if needed. Reliever Nick Birdy, with a hip inflammation, received an anti-inflammatory injection on Monday. The pitcher said he hasn't felt any pain since. Birdy is hoping to get on a mound this weekend. Meanwhile, Boone said that infielder John Birdy, with a groin injury, could potentially begin a rehab assignment on Sunday after a few heavy days of baseball activities in New York. And one more note, Gerrit Cole, with elbow inflammation, will not travel with the Yankees on their upcoming road trip to Milwaukee and Baltimore. He'll continue his rehab in New York. There's still a chance he gets on the mound for the first time next week. And let's see, we will go to the NBA from Boston. Keep reading if you've seen this before. An outmanned Miami team out-toughing and out-shooting the Celtics in a road playoff game. A Boston team bemoaning missed foul goals calls while the Heat splashed threes at the other end. A raucous TD Garden turned silent as if thousands all at once had seen a ghost. Now, let's skip straight to the rub of Boston's latest home playoff loss to Miami. Are these ghosts real? Did Wednesday's 111-101 defeat in Game 2 mark the return of the zombie Heat, undead and unstoppable in the clutch of every Boston series? Or was Miami's upset the result of an impossibly hot three-point shooting performance no team should be able to replicate except in an empty gym? The Celtics might believe one or the other, but they cannot possibly know because no one knows. The same way no one knew the Seas would fall into a 3-0 series hole last year in the Eastern Conference Finals, then tie the series days later. What we can say is there are reasons to believe both, even if Boston rightfully remains an overwhelming favorite to close the series out in 5 or 6. Let's start with the scary. Jaylen Brown admitted the Heat bullied them at times, while the Celtics too often looked to the refs to bail them out. It's a mindset. It's a lifestyle. You just got to embrace it, and I don't think we did, Brown said. They embraced it. Joe Mazzulla admitted that he got out-coached. And we're going to do hockey now. Jack Eichel and the defending Stanley Cup champion Golden Knights got exactly what they anticipated and withstood that early hard push in Game 2 by the desperate Stars. The Knights didn't settle for a split while starting the NHL Western Conference first-round series on the road. Eichel assisted on the tying goal by Jonathan Marshall late in the first period before adding an empty netter late. Noah Hanifin scored the tiebreaker with unassisted goal late in the second and the third. Knights won 3-1 on Wednesday night in Dallas for a 2-0 series lead. Another game, the Kings edged the host Oilers 5-4 on Wednesday night in Game 2 of the West Series, which is tied 1-1. And the Bruins beat the Maple Leafs 4-2 on Wednesday to take a 2-1 lead in the Eastern Conference Final. And we're ready for the weather now. Chris D'Alessandro will give us the weather. And I will be back with more basketball right after that.
If you miss one of your favorite Chris programs, log on to our website, chrisradio.org, and click Chris on Demand. Or register to use our telephone reader service. Call 860-527-8000 for more information.
Your Chris Radio forecast for this evening, clear with a low around 37. Saturday, mostly sunny with a high near 65. Saturday evening, a chance of showers mainly after 1 a.m., mostly cloudy with a low around 43. Sunday, a slight chance of showers again, mostly cloudy with a high near 68. Sunday evening, mostly cloudy with a low around 52. Monday, partly sunny with a high near 75. Monday evening, mostly cloudy with a low around 53. Tuesday, mostly cloudy with a high near 69. Tuesday evening, a chance of rain before 10 p.m., then a chance of showers between 10 p.m. and 2 a.m., mostly cloudy with a low around 51. Wednesday, partly sunny with a high near 74. Wednesday evening, mostly cloudy with a low around 52. And finally, for Thursday, partly sunny with a high near 74. That is your latest forecast on Chris. Now back to sports with Bill Murphy. Bill?
We're going to continue with the NBA playoffs. Rookie Chet Holmgren won his center matchup with Jonas Valanciunas and helped the top-seeded Thunder beat the 8th-seeded Pelicans 124-92 in Game 2 of their Western Conference first-round playoff series Wednesday night in Oklahoma City. Holmgren had 26 points and 7 rebounds as the Thunder took a 2-0 lead. He made 9 of 13 field goals to support Shea Gilgeous-Alexander's 33-point effort. He was really good, Gilgeous-Alexander said. He was in the actions, got out of them, and then put their defense in a bind almost all of the night. And he was making shots, putting it down. He was A-plus tonight for sure. Valanciunas scored 11 points in the first 3 minutes, but did little damage after that. He finished with 19 points and 7 rebounds. The two offer contrasting styles. Holmgren, listed as 7'1" and a slender 208 pounds, is the new age center who shoots three-pointers and can defend any position. He's a finalist for Rookie of the Year and one of the league's best shot blockers. Valanciunas is a 7'270-pound traditional big man. He's a hulking presence who's at his best punishing opponents near the hoop. Valanciunas made 5 of 7 field goals in the first quarter, but 3 of 7 the rest of the game. He's a good player, and he's confident, Holmgren said. They're going to go to him in the post, trying to have him make some plays down there, and it's my job to make those plays as tough as possible. Holmgren struggled at times with the matchup in Game 1, a 94-92 win for Oklahoma City. Though he had 15 points, 11 rebounds, and 5 blocks that night, Valanciunas had 13 points and 20 rebounds, including 9 offensive boards. Early in Game 2, while Valanciunas was doing damage in the paint, Holmgren was stretching the defense. He scored 13 points in the first 7 minutes, including 3 three-pointers. His 15 points in the first quarter were the most any Thunder rookie has scored in any quarter of a playoff game. Holmgren helped set the tone with his willingness to mix it up with Valanciunas. When he wasn't making three-pointers, he was standing up to his much stronger opponent in the paint and using his long arm to help limit Valanciunas to 2 offensive rebounds. They came out physical, Valanciunas said. They were aggressive. And we have a WNBA story here from Seattle. Sue Bird helped the Seattle Storm to 4 WNBA titles. Now she will continue guiding the franchise as one of its owners. Team owners Force 10 Hoops said Wednesday that Bird has joined the ownership group. There was no financial details provided about the transaction. Bird said in a team statement, her involvement with the Storm will continue to grow the game. Investing in women's sports isn't just about passion, she said. It's smart business. Business has been good for the Storm during Bird's nearly 2 decades as a player. She was the number 1 overall pick by Seattle in 2002 in the WNBA draft and played 19 seasons. She retired after the 2022 season as the league's all-time assist leader with 3,234. Bird was part of WNBA championships in 2004, 2010, 2018, and 2020. Storm co-owner Lisa Brummel said Bird's knowledge of the game and the league, plus her business acumen, make her a superb addition. The ownership group recently opened the Seattle Storm Center for Basketball Performance, a new $64 million practice facility. None of the teams full of Division I scholarship athletes across the country were able to hang with UConn this season as the Huskies rolled to a 37-3 record and a second straight national title. So on Wednesday, UConn students got their shot at the champs. Hassan Diarra, Samson Johnson, Andrew Hurley, and even former Husky star and Charlotte guard James Booknight showed up to play some pickup basketball at the new recreation center on campus, taking on any and all comers. It caused quite a shift stir as UConn's began showing up as the night went on, according to UConn football intern and Daily Campus Associate Sports Editor Evan Rodriguez, who was there and posted video and pictures of the scene to X. Word started circling around and everyone was trying to get on the court, Rodriguez told The Current. They dropped like two teams in a row and started screaming, "Who's next?" Rodriguez posted videos of Booknight coasting for one of the most effortless-looking jams you'll ever see over a hapless student. He also had video of 6'8" sophomore Apostolos Ramoglu, who entered his name into the transfer portal this week, throwing down in transition. Then there's one of Samson Johnson, who's likely to compete for the starting center role next season, dunking on a couple of students, though it could have been more emphatic. Freshman 6'10 center Yusuf Singari tried to bring the ball up, was stripped by a student running up behind him, then chased him down and sent the student's ill-fated layup attempt thunderously off the backboard. Although another student got the rebound and scored before Singari could react, the Huskies freshman made up for his turnover by bringing the ball up the court, Giannis Antetokounmpo style, and slamming home a dunk in traffic. Fans on social media had some fun with the videos, with one quipping, "Are you sure this isn't just an alternate view of the Illinois game?" Jeffrey Walsh posted to X, "Regular students, better get us now," in reference to Dan Hurley's famous quote after a UConn loss to Villanova in 2020. Rodriguez said a team with Booknight, Diarra, and Johnson actually lost the game to the students. Maybe Purdue could have used them. But it was clear the players weren't trying that hard. The men's basketball players then had to get off the court as only winners stay on and move to another court on the opposite side of the gym. Crowds, of course, followed, and the players dominated their other pickup games. It was awesome to just be there as a student, Rodriguez said. It's just cool. It makes UConn feel more like the basketball capital of the world. And I'm going to give you the what's on the air, and then I'm going to read about the NFL draft as much as I can. First, what's on the air today? Baseball, 5 games on TV. Kansas City at Detroit. It's on the MLB Network at 1 p.m. At 7 p.m., Chicago Cubs at the Red Sox. That's on NESN, Radio 1080 WTIC. 7 p.m., St. Louis at the New York Mets. It's on Apple TV Plus, also Radio 880 WCBS in New York. 7:30 p.m., Tampa Bay at the Chicago White Sox. That's on Apple TV Plus. And 8 p.m., the Yankees at Milwaukee. That's on the YES Network, and it's on Radio 97.9. Now, in basketball, in the NBA, Eastern Conference first-round playoff, Milwaukee at Indiana, Game 3. That's on ESPN. 8 p.m., Western Conference first-round playoff, L.A. Clippers at Dallas, Game 3. That's on ESPN. 10:30 p.m., Western Conference first-round playoff, Minnesota at Phoenix, Game 3. That is on ESPN. And here's the hockey. 7 p.m., Eastern Conference first-round playoff, New York Rangers at Washington Capitals, Game 3, TNT. 7:30 p.m., Western Conference first-round playoff, Vancouver at Nashville, Game 3, TBS. 10 p.m., Western Conference first-round playoff, Winnipeg at Colorado, Game 3, TNT. 10:30 p.m., Western Conference first-round playoff, Edmonton at Los Angeles, Game 3. That is on TBS. And I'm going to start this article on NFL draft, which started last night, I believe. It's in Detroit. The NFL draft has taken a show on the road for a decade, giving cities around the country a chance to be in the spotlight. Detroit's time is now. The Motor City, which was once one of the nation's largest and most powerful cities, has bounced back from filing for bankruptcy in 2013. Fans driving and flying into town from the league's other 31 teams saw signs of progress from the symbolic to the significant. Detroit is spelled out, each letter standing 10 feet off of an embankment alongside a freeway between the airport and downtown in an art installation that made its debut earlier this month. A few miles away, the long-abandoned Michigan Central Station has undergone a renovation funded by Ford Motor Company to transform the 18-story, 113-year-old train depot from an eyesore into a gem. Downtown, where the NFL draft began Thursday night, a 685-foot-high tower represents the largest construction project in the city in more than a half century as it rises from the site of the former Hudson's department store. With more than 50 million viewers and an expected 400,000 visitors over the three-day event, there will be a chance to change the conversation about the city. Lions President Rod Wood pitched the city as a draft destination in 2016 and teamed up with the Detroit Sports Commission to submit the formal bid to land the NFL's annual event that gives fans from each team a jolt of hope. The Lions and the local sports commission also partnered with Visit Detroit, Dan Gilbert's real estate company, Bedrock, and the Detroit Police Department to make the most of the opportunity. The draft here in Detroit is going to make a big step for us in making the old image go away and people having the new image of the city, Gilbert told the Associated Press earlier this month. We're going to be able to showcase Detroit like never before. That's part of the NFL's plan and has led to 20-plus cities vying for a future draft. Green Bay will host next year's draft. After the league had its last draft in New York a decade ago, it envisioned giving cities, particularly those in colder climates that may not host a future Super Bowl, a chance to have a signature event that would have a lot of benefits, including an economic impact. Chicago was the first tour stop in 2015, and it generated $81 million for the community. Kansas City had it last year, sparking $164 million in economic impact. Another opportunity for our franchise and our city, and just for the world, to kind of migrate to downtown Detroit, said Lions General Manager Brad Holmes, who has turned around a franchise that is coming off its best season since winning the 1957 NFL title. I expect it to be pretty packed. I'm excited for all the businesses. Detroit's draft is expected to bring in at least $160 million, giving small businesses a boost from fans flocking in and around campus Marcius Park. One longtime business is looking forward to more than just an increase in foot traffic. Lawrence Stovall, the business lead at Hot Sam's, and two others representing the 103-year-old men's clothing store and tailor shop will be on stage during the draft's final day Saturday. There's a perception of Detroit that comes from people who actually have not been here, Stovall said. What's so great is when people actually come to Detroit, they are blown away because Detroit is not what they thought it might have been. And that's it for the sports for today. I'm Bill Murphy. Thank you very much for listening. Hope you have a great weekend, everybody, and please stay safe.